court will proceed to the fifth case, Czarnecki versus the City of Chicago. Mr. Platt?
Morning. May it please the Court. Stephen Platt on behalf of the plaintiff and appellant, Mr. Wojciech Czarnecki. This is a combined appeal, and it involves basically the interplay of Title VII and a Section 1983 case in its bare essence. And the essence of what happened here is we brought a 1983 claim from Mr. Czarnecki. And as we've indicated in the record below, we were unable to, we had requested, but we're not in a position to obtain a right to sue letter from the EEOC or through the state process. So we brought the 1983 claim. And the court denied summary judgment as to the individual ADS Tobias, Assistant Deputy Superintendent Tobias, but granted it as to the city. Then the city came in and moved to limit damages on the 1983 claim against that we could seek on the individual, making it basically an untriable case because there were damages limitations were such that there were no reinstatement and other elements of damages, which we think is an inconsistent position with what they're taking now because now they're saying that the cases are basically the same. We then non-suited the part on Mr. Tobias and came back after we were able to get the right to sue letter with the Title VII case, and the city moved to dismiss on the grounds of res judicata, which was granted. So those two issues are conjoined here today. We're saying a couple of things here. First of all, we're arguing that the dismissal against the city was wrong. And secondly, we're arguing that regardless of what happened in the 1983 case, that the Title VII case should be allowed to proceed. We've cited to a case called Buckhalter, which is out of the Seventh Circuit, and Tennessee versus Elliott, which is a Supreme Court case, which talks about the differences between Title VII and 1983. And essentially, we've also argued the state rule, the same transaction versus same evidence test. We say that the rule is the same evidence test, but even if the same transaction test were to apply in terms of res judicata, when you get into a damages question, as the city did, it allows you to bring the second claim. And we cite to the restatement specifically. By the way, I didn't reserve it. I'd like to reserve a minute of time for rebuttal, if I may. The restatement gives the best examples of it. The restatement gives two examples of why the same transaction test would not apply here. One is they say, well, if A sues B on a contract claim for specific performance and the court dismisses the case saying it's not a specific performance case, then A can sue B for damages. It's not barred by res judicata as the same transaction. That's essentially what we have here because we have the city taking the position that certain damages are not available when all you have is the individual defendant. So if the damages claims are different, then how can there be a res judicata based on the analogy and the argument as set forth by the restatement? The second thing is that they point to an example of what they mean by the same transaction test, and they cite to a case called Mays, in which the there were nine separate challenges to an administrator's ruling on a contract claim. And what they're saying, in essence, is if you have the same transaction, you have to have a lot of the same type of incidents before you can say that the same transactions apply. In addition to that, a broader argument that we've made is that Title VII would not have been enacted, and it's a different statutory scheme if 1983 was, in fact, in essence, the same claim, the same type of cause of action. There would be no reason for the 1964 Civil Rights Act if the 1983 cases were sufficient by themselves.
Apart from applying to private employers?
Well, yes, private and public employers, both. Yeah. But, the Title VII scheme has, as you know, it does apply to, it has much broader protection. But if you take it in terms of the private employers, even if you look at the private employers, you have 1981, 1983. Obviously, the statutes that existed after the Civil War were not sufficient. If they were, there would be no reason for Title VII. And in addition to that, Title VII sets up a statutory scheme where there's an administrative mechanism, there's an agency. Now they have certain rulemaking authority and abilities and things of that sort. So it's an entirely different procedure. Plus, there's all kinds of case law that talks about deferral to state fair employment practices agencies and the like. So these are not really the same types of statutes, although they are similar in some ways, but they're not identical. And to indicate that that they are and to apply the res judicata bar is wrong. And I think the court recognized that with the Buckholder case. Now, Buckholder was a slightly different fact situation than what we have here, but the discussion was the same because Buckholder involved the interplay of 1983 and Title VII. And what they said was that at the agency level, if they had a ruling, they actually had a trial at the agency level under the equivalent of Title VII, the State Fair Practices Employment Act, the Illinois Human Rights Act. But they had a trial and the person lost, and they were allowed to bring a Title VII claim in federal court because the court said that there were different types of schemes, and they said the difference was as long as they didn't appeal it to the state court on appeal, that it was not barred by res judicata. So we think that those decisions and the arguments that we made in the briefs are pretty much self-explanatory. In addition to the 1983 claim, we have argument with the way that that was decided. This is a case involving a police recruit. He and, as we referred to it, there's another case pending. He and Mr. Palka, which is another case pending in this court right now, both of Polish ethnic origin, were fired within a week of each other, and Tobias went through the same litany. He just brought them into his office, and he asked them, you know, where are they from? Where are their parents from? Poland. What language do they speak in the home? Polish. And then he blew up at them and said, we don't need people like you, and then within a week they're fired. And the city says, well, he's not a policymaker, but he is a policymaker. He's a policymaker as far as the police academy is concerned, and he, in fact, boasts in the Zarnecki case, as we pointed out, that he has never failed to get somebody terminated that he's recommended for termination. So he had the ability to effectively recommend. So if he wants someone fired, they're fired. And within a week, Zarnecki is fired. He has a property interest in the job, as police officers do. He has a liberty interest in terms of being a police officer, the protection of his good name and the reputation for honor and integrity. His name is being besmirched because he's being fired for violating a rule, for not being honest. It will then affect him in terms of his ability to work in the law enforcement field. And it stigmatizes him, and of course the city has, you know, the ability to disclose this. So the elements were proven, and we think the dismissal of the claim below was improper on the 1983 case itself. So for all of those reasons, unless someone has anything they want to ask, I think the decision below should be reversed, both of them.
Thank you, Mr. Platt. Ms. Masters.
May it please the Court. Let me begin where Mr. Platt just left off, because it's our position that the merits of the 1983 dismissal against the city are not on appeal. They're not before the court. They were not briefed. The issue before the court today is whether the dismissal of the Title VII claim, which came after the dismissal of the 1983 claim, was properly done based upon res judicata. Now, to be clear, of course, the court is well familiar with three elements of res judicata. To begin with, Mr. Zarnecki has never contested that the dismissal of the 1983 case was final on the merits. So that issue is resolved. The second issue, did the two cases, the 1983 case and the Title VII case, involve the same parties? Again, Mr. Zarnecki did not contest that element before the court below. In this court, he can't raise it on appeal. As we point out in our brief, it's waived, as is the question about whether there was a final decision on the merits. That was waived as well. And even if not waived, we're willing to rest on our brief for the proposition that the City of Chicago, as it appeared in the 1983 case, is the same exact party as the City of Chicago in the Title VII case. That leaves before the court the question of whether or not those two cases involve the same core of operative facts. Now, in their opening brief, Mr. Zarnecki devoted about 12 pages to the argument that the two cases didn't involve the same core of operative facts. In his reply brief, he adopts a new strategy of arguing that the same evidence test purportedly used to judge the preclusive effect of decisions by Illinois state courts applies. Now, that argument not only is waived because it was raised for the first time in his reply brief, but it's wrong on the merits. First of all, of course, this court is considering the preclusive effect of a prior federal court judgment on federal claims. It is not a question of the preclusive effect of a state court judgment. And beyond that, the case we cite to this court of Garcia versus Village of Mount Prospect recognizes that the Illinois Supreme Court in a 1998 case entitled River Park versus City of Highland Park unequivocally adopted the same transaction approach. So it's not even a correct statement of Illinois law to say that the same evidence test applies. And applying the same transaction test, it's clear that Mr. Czarnecki's Title VII and his 1983 claims arise from the same core of operative facts. Both cases clearly arise out of his dismissal by the city at ADS Tobias's recommendation and his claim that ADS Tobias's recommendation was based upon national origin discrimination. There is no dispute in this case about that issue. And in fact, in his first brief before the court, he states on page 26 that he had the right to bring a subsequent Title VII case against the city based upon same or similar facts. Now, Mr. Platt has just relied upon the Buckhalter case, but the Buckhalter case is clearly distinguishable. That case has to do with the preclusive effect of a state adjudication and unreviewed state administrative findings on a Title VII claim. And, of course, that's not the situation we have here. He also talks about how Title VII has different remedies. Well, we don't dispute that. Of course, Title VII has different remedies. But, again, the law of res judicata is about whether the cases arise from the same core of operative facts. It's not about whether there are different remedies available. And Smith versus City of Chicago, which we also cite to the court, specifically says it simply doesn't matter that you can have different remedies. That still means you're supposed to bring your claims together. He also argues that he couldn't bring his Title VII claim with his 1983 case. But the fact of the matter is there are multiple cases, such as Herman, Prokotsky, which state that even if you can't at the moment bring your Title VII case when you're ready to bring your Section 1983 case, there are ways to prevent res judicata from barring your Title VII case. You can seek a stay of your Section 1983 case. You can wait to bring your 1983 case. He had a two-year statute of limitations here. Or you can go to the EEOC and request your right to sue letter. Now, Mr. Czarnecki did none of those things. Instead, he let those opportunities go by. He moved to dismiss his case, and now he is stuck with the result. And that is not a reason to reverse the district court. The district court was clearly correct on all of the elements of res judicata and should be affirmed. So for these reasons and those we set forth in our brief, we ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Mr. Platt.
Let me correct a reference to the record. The record below, we had declarations from two individuals from the EEOC, two supervisors, the deputy director of the EEOC, the number two person in the office, who said that they would not and did not issue the right to sue letters, but they were requested. They wouldn't do it because it was pending in the state court and the state proceeding. And, in fact, they didn't do it despite the fact that it was requested. We also had a declaration from the plaintiff, Mr. Czarnecki, indicated that he requested it and didn't get it. So that reference about what was not in the record is just flat out wrong. The requests were made, and when we were not able to obtain them, and as a matter of policy, the EEOC doesn't just give you a right to sue letter when you request it, and in fact, they're not allowed to, because the statutory scheme requires them to do the investigation. Secondly, I appeal to those of you who have been on the district court. If you think a district court judge would sit there and stay a federal court case, I think it's all three, isn't it?
All three.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I mean. I should have said all of you. I apologize. But I know that you've all been on the district court. But, I mean, I think of yourselves. Well, would you grant a stay for two and a half years to a federal action? while we're waiting for the EEOC to issue a right to sue letter? Maybe you would.
I did.
Okay. Awesome. Well, you're more generous than a lot of the other judges are in reality. As a matter of reality-based fact in this court, the judges will not do that because the cases have to move forward. And if we're faced with having to go in front of a judge every 30 to 60 days to explain why we don't have a right to sue letter, that's a very uncomfortable position to be in. And sooner or later, there's going to be a judge who's going to dismiss the case because they're not going to wait, or they're going to move forward under 1983. It's not a practical explanation. And in those other cases that counsel cited, they were not examples of cases where they had a record like we prepared here, where there were affidavits or declarations from the EEOC individuals and from the plaintiff indicating what they attempted to do. So those cases may talk in generalities, but they are not the same from a factual standpoint as what we've had here. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Platt. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.